show dedicated to free your mind. With your host, Davey D, on the Teacher Station, 106.1 KMEL-FM, San Francisco, Oakland, and San Jose. Come alive.
Maggot-colored clouds billow then bounce, would send my mind racing upward, higher, 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 and higher. I feel the sun's warmth, see the stars shine, rise above the atmosphere. Head rushing, mind spinning, eyes squinting from brightness of light, which is not really there. I feel powerful, invincible, I feel my feet lifting off the ground as I rapidly ascend to heaven's pearl-colored gates. But suddenly, as quickly as I rise, my descent begins. A multitude of frantic fluorescent lights flicker as I tumble non-stop to the cold ground below. A deep depression sweeps my mind as if it were a brisk autumn wind beckoning winter. And I fall, lights dim. But I long to rise to see again the brightness. For I am crashing towards Earth, towards reality. I so want to escape. And I fall. Faster, I cannot breathe. Faster, faster, I cannot breathe. Faster, I cannot breathe. Faster, breathe, faster, cannot, faster, breathe, breathe, cannot breathe. I cannot breathe. And darkness becomes blackness as I plummet down. Furiously fighting demonic moods which swirl, hurling daggers at my rabid soul. I cannot breathe. Thoughts turn ugly. I hate myself so much. I would do anything to leave this earth. Like suck the smoke from this pipe of death as I fall and fall and fall and fall. And then the ground opens. I see a grave. And I'm falling, crying, screaming, dying. Am I dreaming? No, I have killed myself. As darkness becomes peace, tranquility, a deep, deep sleep.
Cocaine entered the scene. Those busted for dealing the drug have all been black. Some, including federal court judges, say it looks like the Justice Department is targeting crack dealers by race. But feds explain that most crack dealers are black. Take LA as an example. But why, of all ethnic groups in California, has crack embedded itself in LA? Well, that's the question Jesse Jackson and Congresswoman Maxine Waters and Barbara Boxer are asking the government. They, along with others, are calling for investigations into the relationship between the CIA and targeting drugs toward the inner cities. There's apparently a CIA contra crack connection. According to a recent San Jose Mercury News series, cocaine dealers working for the CIA's Nicaraguan force created a crack cocaine epidemic, supplying cut-rate cocaine to the gangs of LA through most of the 80s. The head of the drug ring's Southern California operation, Danilo Blandon, has admitted in federal court testimony that he and other exiles sold drugs in black LA neighborhoods to raise money for the CIA's army, known in the U.S. as the Contras. But unlike young blacks serving time for selling crack, Blandon is a free man. He has a huge home in Nicaragua and an exporting business supported by the U.S. government. the CIA's inspector general, will investigate, but he believes there's no truth in the matter.
What's up, Northern California? This is Jesse Jackson, representing on Street Knowledge. Speak your mind, free your mind, and be heard on the People's Station, 106 KMEL. Keep hope alive.
Just like you. There's another girl in the dope man's life. Not a prostitute, but far from a wife. She's called a strawberry, and everybody knows strawberry, strawberry is good to go. Do anything for a hit or two. If the girl rock, there's nothing she won't do. Might be a wife, sister, or girlfriend. Come home and see her in the bed with the dope man. Strawberry just look as she pleases. But don't mess around, she carries diseases. And people out there not a strawberry is a girl selling body for crack to the
dope man, dope man.
Hey man, give me a hit.
Dope man, dope man.
Boy, you need to quit.
Dope man, dope man.
In your face. It's your train. Kick in the bass.
If you smoke cane, you're nothing but a sucker. Known around the hood as a schoolyard clucker. Doing that crack with all the money you got on your head.
hands and knees searching for a piece of rock.
Jumping for a hit and you're looking for more. Done stole an Alpine out of Easy 6-4. You need to be woke cause it's out of this earth. Can't get a 10-piece, need a $1.50 worth.
Knucklehead boy, yeah, you turn into a crook. But swear up and down, fool, that you ain't hooked. You kick your friend out and you beat his butt long.
Cause he hit the pipe till the rock was all gone.
You robbing and stealing, bugging and illing while the dope man's dealing. What is healing your pain? Cocaine, this world's insane. Selling crack to another in the fast lane.
Strawberries out there to play the role.
Man, I wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole.
Me neither, I just stop and grin.
Dope man in the pen doing 5 to 10.
Well, I'm the dope man, got caught selling crack. Now my face is in the dirt and the police is on my back. I used to sell coke every day on the street. Now the chow line is where I eat. So stop what you're doing, that ain't what it's about. Cause sooner or later it's gonna play out. There's money in the street, but I'll tell you what, either dead or in jail is where you end up. I know for a fact that's how it could be.
Hey, dope man.
No, that's not me. Now to sell crack is not the move. I just did it for the girls called money and jewels. I was the
dope man, dope man.
I was my
dope man, dope man.
Boy, get a job.
Dope man, dope man.
As much as he can.
What you say your name was?
The dope man.
Yo, Mr. Dope Man, you think you're slick. You sold crack to my sister and now she's sick. But if she happened to die because of your drug, I'm putting in the hole a 38 slug.
Yo, what's up? This is Chuck D of Public Enemy, and now is the time to talk back to your radio. Street knowledge with the host, Davey D, on the People Station 106 KMEL.
All right, good morning, everybody. Welcome, welcome, welcome to another edition of Street Knowledge. We have I guess it's going to be a very intense show, and you might want to call as many people as possible this morning. We're going to talk about, as you can gather from the songs that we played, we're going to talk about crack. I don't know anybody, especially those of us who live in certain areas, say our minority communities, in particular, the Black and Latino communities, the ghetto, the hood. I don't know anybody who has not have this drug affect them one way or the other. Either we know people that's been on it. We've been victimized by people that have been trying to get it. Drug dealing in some of our neighborhoods has become the number one way to make money. A lot of people fund their legal businesses through drug money, fast drug money, the sale of crack cocaine. And a lot of people, they often say, well, you know, somebody just flooded the community, but nobody ever knew why, and nobody ever knew how, and nobody ever knew who did it. Well, we have a special show today, and we're going to talk to some people that's going to really break it down to you. In case you're not familiar, I guess about 3-4 weeks ago, towards the end of August, there was a special three-part series called Dark Alliances. It was featured in the San Jose Mercury. It was an investigative piece that kind of traced the roots and talked about how, yes, right, the Black community, the impoverished Black community in Los Angeles, through the sale and buying of crack cocaine, helped fund the Contras during their revolution when they were trying to defeat the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. And we're going to talk about how the CIA knew about this, and we're going to talk about how the CIA under Ronald Reagan understood some of the key players and allowed them to do business and to deal something that is still ravaging our community to this day. And that's what we're going to talk about, crack cocaine, how it's affected us. And let me tell you our special guest that we have in the studio. We have the investigative reporter from the San Jose Mercury. His name is Gary Webb. He's on his way in. He got turned around on the Bay Bridge. He's never been here before, but he'll be right here. We have a favorite person right here who's frequent the Street Knowledge program, Akani Themba from the Praxis Project. And she's a drug policy person. She knows all about this. We're going to be talking to her. We also have the author of a book called Pipe Dream Blues, Racism in the War on Drugs. And here's Gary. Gary Webb has just walked in. And his name is Clarence Lusane. We're going to be talking to him. We also have some young activists, people who definitely have their finger on the pulse, young writers, young activists, people who've been out there. We have Mr. Kevin Weston and Troy Nkrumah. I hope I pronounced your name right, brother, from the Young Comrades and Project Rebound. And we also will be joined later on after the 10 o'clock hour by Keith Muhammad from the Nation of Islam. And that can only be said because those guys have really been dealing with the crack epidemic on the front line, trying to get a lot of people to quit and get some discipline and spirituality in their life. Meantime, what I want to ask everybody today is, how has the crack epidemic affected you? How has it ravaged your life? And what do you think we need to do about it? That's the overriding question that we're asking today. And before we go to our guests, let me take a couple of calls since we have a number of people that have been holding. Also, let me give out the phone numbers. 478-524 and 575 in the South Bay is the phone number if you'd like to comment on and tell us how the crack epidemic has affected you. So give us a call right now. In the meantime, let me go to our phone lines right now, and we're going to kick it off with Sheldon from Santa Clara. Sheldon, you're on Street Knowledge. How you doing today?
Good, Dave. How you been?
Good. Talk to us now.
Well, Dave, first of all, I want to thank you for having the program. This is wonderful. This is exactly what we need. And I'm 35 years old. First 27 years of my life was spent in East Oakland, so I've seen it firsthand. And to answer your question, the way it has affected me, I've seen family members and friends go down, been shot, strung out, still strung out.
Mm-hmm.
I had an uncle who got a bad needle, heroin, died of AIDS.
Wow.
So I have been there. And the thing is, the whole thing about the money, Dave, is that dealers are not getting rich off this. Dealers are not getting rich off this. The government's getting rich off this, and nobody's going to change my mind
about
that.
Can you repeat that again?
Dealers are not getting rich off this. Only
so you're
the government.
The government. And a lot of people would say that's a radical statement to say the government.
Hey, it's just real.
They would say that's something that is preposterous, not our government, not our tax-paying government.
No, because it's real, Dave. They don't do no wrong, right? They don't do no wrong.
Well, we're going to talk about that. I appreciate that, okay?
Bet.
All right, let me take another call. Mike from Hercules. You're on Street Knowledge,
morning.
Mike. How you doing?
Hey, I'm doing all right. Hey, but you know, the gentleman that just called before me, he hit the ball on the head. I don't think there's too many black people that have not been affected by this crack cocaine. Because I had to put my ex-wife out of here behind that crack cocaine.
Right.
And consequently, I'm taking care of my children.
Right.
But, you know, I'm going to take you back to the 1980s when the war with the Contras was going on.
Mm-hmm.
They had a CIA pilot. His last name was Hagen or Haas or something like that, right?
Right.
So anyway, he flies down these plane load of guns. On his way out of Nicaragua, he gets shot down, and he's got a plane load of cocaine. But who in the U.S. Customs Service is going to search Air America? No one, right?
Right.
So they've been bringing this stuff in here, and they've been directly affecting the black community. I take you back to the movie The Godfather. Give it to the blacks.
Well, you know, the question that I would like to ask, and I'm posing this not just to you, but to everybody, knowing that this is happening, what has encouraged so many people to gravitate towards this drug? What has allowed so many people to allow this to just devastate their lives to the degree that it has?
Well, you know, I think it's all by design, man. I think it's a master plan that they've cooked up in a think tank. And because this is just not by accident. Why aren't they targeting other communities with this?
Well, I think a lot of communities have been affected by this right now.
None is so devastating as the black community.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just like that gentleman said before. Whole families have been ravaged by this, and my family included.
Right.
You know? And I'm going to tell you, I hate drug dealers. But I think that the government is behind all of this.
Okay.
You know? And it burns me up. Because I look at my children, they don't have a mother. They don't have a mother. And it's directly a result of that damn drug.
Okay.
And, I don't know what the attraction is because... Hey, I don't want nothing to do with that stuff. And some people have a misconception that they can handle it. The only way to handle it is to leave it to hell alone.
Right. Well, I appreciate that. And we're going to continue our conversation
in
a bit.
And I'll be listening to you.
Okay, let me just reintroduce our guests again. We have Makani Themba from the Praxis Project. Good morning, Makani. How you doing?
Good morning. I'm just fine. How are you?
Okay, we also have Gary Webb, the investigative reporter who's been blowing up the spot literally with his investigative piece, the three-part series entitled Dark Alliances that was featured in the San Jose Mercury. How you doing?
All right.
You got
I'm
here okay?
Here finally, yeah.
We also have some folks that are always having their finger on the pulse in the community, the Young Comrades, and that's representing them is Kevin Weston and Troy Nkrumah. How you guys doing? Let me give a mic check from you guys.
What's up, y'all? What's up?
Yeah.
All right. And also, we will be joined later on this morning by Keith Muhammad from the Nation of Islam. And we'll also be joined by Congresswoman Maxine Waters and author of the book Pipe Dream Blues, Clarence Lussain. Meantime, I'm going to give out the phone numbers. I want you all to give us a call and offer your comments and opinions on today's discussion, in particular, how crack has affected your life and the lives around you. And when we come back, we're going to talk to our guests right here on the People Station, 106 KMEL.
Yo, check this out. Chuck D, a public enemy, telling you that street knowledge is your chance to let us know what's up. Call us now at 415-478-KMEL in the city. In the East Bay, 510-524-KMEL. And in the South Bay, 408-575-KMEL. Call.
Yo.
DJ Joe Cooley in the house.
On Street Knowledge with Davey D, expanding your mind on 106 KMEL, your community action station, because action speaks louder than words.
You're with Davey D on Street Knowledge, 106 KMEL.
That's right. Can't deny it. Cocaine business controls America. That's what we're talking about. Crack epidemic. What it did to certain communities in this country is just unbelievable. And we're going to talk about it this morning. I want to start it off with my guest, Makani Themba. When we talk about crack, for people who aren't familiar out there, what are we talking about?
Okay.
I mean, is it something? Is it like some marijuana? Is it a pill? What exactly are we talking about here?
Well, essentially, it's cocaine that's been processed with, well, I won't give out the recipe for the wannabes.
Right.
But essentially, it's been processed in a way so that you remove the hydrochloride so it can be smoked.
Okay.
And it can, and not safely, but at least it could be heated. So, and then it makes little, you know, like it comes out in little rocks, essentially.
Right. And the thing that made crack such an explosive drug is that I've read that it's like 10 times addictive as cocaine itself. It's something that...
Well, it's not... Well, let's be clear. First, crack is essentially not as potent in terms of the actual substance as powder cocaine, mm-hmm. but when you smoke something as opposed to inhaling it, no matter what it is, it's approximately 10 times, you know, more potent in your system.
Right.
I mean, that's the difference. The smoking it is what makes the difference.
Okay. Now, when we talk about the type of effect it's had, I mean, from a drug policy standpoint, what have you found to be the case with crack?
Well, it's extremely addictive, but I think the thing that's most important is that it's cheap. Mm-hmm. I mean, what we know about any product is, you know, you have like the four P's, like price, product, you know, promotion, and and place. And the thing is and all, if you have all those four P's together, no matter what the product is, you kind of blow up.
Right.
So you had a cheap price. Mm-hmm. They had a pipeline. It was available everywhere, through every housing project, just about every liquor store, a lot of corners. It was accessible, and the promotion was out there. I mean, they came out on the market giving out freebies, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And for $5, you could get totally high.
I know people that have gotten hooked just on that. You mm-hmm. know, going to a party, I had somebody I used to work with, and they gave him a cigarette that was laced with crack, and next thing you know, the man was hooked.
Mm-hmm.
Still hooked. I mean, went from being like a straight-A student at Cal Berkeley to a thief, you know, that was willing to steal from his mama damn near just to get his fix.
But I think it's what's got to be clear, though, is that even though there's a lot of people who are using crack, that the most addictive part of crack in our community has been the money, not
uh-huh.
the product.
Really?
In that there's a lot of misconceptions about who uses crack. In fact, there's a lot of whites who use crack, but they have more access to treatment.
Don't they call it crank?
No.
Oh, that's different.
A different
okay.
thing.
Okay.
And we won't want to break down that recipe either. But there's a lot of whites that use crack. Crack is actually also an older people's drug. Not a lot of really young people use it. A lot
right.
of young people sell it but not use it. But the real addiction has been the money. That's been the issue. People unemployed, you know, who had this opportunity to make more money. And I know when I used to work at another social service agency, I would get calls from mothers, can you please get my son out of jail? He got hit. He pays the rent. Brother's like 15, 16 years old, and he pays the rent for the whole house. I mean, that's a serious kind of addiction.
Right.
An addiction to the businesses and the jewelry stores and the sporting goods stores, where all of a sudden they could sell $200 sneakers, and they could never. I mean, you know, when you and I were coming up, you know, we had to beg our mamas for some cons, you know.
Right.
I mean, so it's like a whole economy that
grew out
of this.
When I was coming up, it was Pumas.
Yeah, but see, you know, don't even try to play it off.
Not going to age me on this show.
Yes, I am.
Okay, well, I think you made your point then. I appreciate that. Gary Webb, man of the hour, so to speak. A lot of attention has been focused on your article, Dark Alliances. And it's real interesting because at first when it came out in the San Jose Mercury, a lot of people kind of downplayed it. And all of a sudden it just started bubbling over. And even now there seems to be a large number of people that are afraid to kind of get into this whole thing. And I guess let's go back into time a little and tell us what you wrote about for people who hadn't read the San Jose Mercury.
I did a story, or actually a series of stories, about a drug ring that operated here in the Bay Area from the late 70s to, you know, probably 91. And some remnants of it are still around. And these guys were Nicaraguans. They were, you know, anti-communists. And they were using the cocaine pipeline to raise money for this army the CIA put together to...
Called the Contras
to kick the Sandinistas out of Nicaragua because we didn't like them because they were socialists and they were Marxists and that was bad for us.
Now, so. People might not remember this, but there was a whole big debate about this.
This was
during the time that Reagan was in office, and he wanted to, he called the Contras, I guess, our freedom fighters because they were going to keep communism out of Nicaragua.
He called them more than that. They were the moral equivalent of the founding fathers.
That's what he said. Yeah, he would say something like that. Okay.
And, and these guys were essentially ex-National Guardsmen from the dictator's army down there that the Sandinistas beat, and they got together and the CIA put them in a bunch and
right.
said, let's go fight. And the problem was they didn't have a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
So these cocaine dealers in San Francisco who were, you know, supporting these guys.
Now, this is just cocaine itself, powder.
This is cocaine powder, yeah. They right. weren't selling crack. These guys were just bringing the raw material in. And they were bringing it in by the boatload. Literally, by the boatload.
Now, did the government know about this at the time? And who were some of the key players? Because I know in an article you mentioned a couple, like a guy named Blandin, and then it's a guy named Meneses, and I wanted to know if you could kind of break it down.
I'll work my way down from the top. Norman Meneses was the guy that was running the drug ring here in the United States. He's the guy that lived in San Francisco.
Okay.
He
was from Nicaragua.
He was from Nicaragua.
Okay.
And he came to the United States in 79 after the Sandinistas took over because it was too hot for him down there.
Right.
And then he had a guy working for him in L.A. named Danilo Blandón, who was a former Nicaraguan government official who came to the United States for the same reason, because he was on the wrong side of the war.
Right.
And
their big problem at the time that the Sandinistas came into town, and this is kind of important, that's why we're going over it, folks, is that they lived a privileged lifestyle. They were very rich, and basically the perception was is that they were rich at the expense of all the people that were down there in Nicaragua.
It was a two-class society. You had very rich people close to Somoza, and then you had the rest of society, which sort of scrabbled out a living when they could. And when the Sandinistas came along, these guys had been running the country for 40 years, and everybody looked around and saw what kind of crap they were living in, and they threw the guy out. And it upset the United States because this guy was our friend.
Right. And the United States, of course, has always had a bad habit of going to bed with dictators and folks like that.
Yeah, it's all in national security interest.
Right. So now we have this situation where we have two people who were very prominent in Nicaraguan government that were on the side of the Contras, I guess, at this point, who had been ousted by the Sandinistas. They're here in the United States, and they're dealing cocaine. Now, at the time that they were dealing cocaine, was this to fund money for...
That's what Danilo Blandone testified to. I mean, the guy's now working for the government, and when he blurted out all this stuff, he was on the witness stand as a government witness, and he was under oath.
Mm-hmm.
And what he said was that they started selling cocaine to help the Contras, and he was the guy that was sent down to L.A. to do it.
And the CIA knew about this.
Well, I don't know. You know, his lawyer says that that Danilo Blandone was probably with the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody could ask him that in court because before the trial, they got a court order saying you can't ask the guy about his connections to the CIA, so we don't know.
Right. Now, what happened after this? He testifies about the CIA. Now, there was another key player.
Yeah, the other key player is this guy named Freeway Rick Ross.
And this is a black guy that lived in Los Angeles.
About 19, 20 years old.
You tennis player.
He was a tennis player for Dorsey High School and a real good one. And he was going to get a college scholarship, except he couldn't read or write. And so they told him, you know, you can't go to college if you're illiterate. And he started looking for something else to do. And that something else started to be stolen car parts. And then he went on to start dealing cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when he met this Nicaraguan guy, he eventually became the biggest crack dealer in Los Angeles.
Now, what happened after this? And you described in one of the series, I guess it was series two, you kind of went into how he all of a sudden became the man down in Los Angeles.
Well,
and how...
It was you know, simple market economics. Blandone was bringing in all this great, high-grade cocaine. He had an endless supply of it, and it was cheaper by half than anything anybody else in town was selling.
Right.
So Rick just started, he started selling it, and he put the money back into more cocaine. And
now the thing that was interesting is that you talked about that at the time that this guy Blandone, who was with a Nicaraguan guy, that he came up with this whole concept of taking powdered cocaine, which was used primarily in affluent neighborhoods and selling it to poor people.
He had an MBA in marketing. That's the thing to understand about this guy. Was not some corner dealer. He'd been working with the Nicaraguan government, and his job in Nicaragua was to create wholesale markets for agricultural products.
Okay.
That's what he was doing before he came to the United States. And what he ended up doing was going to Los Angeles and creating a wholesale market for powder cocaine where there was no market before. It was too expensive to sell in South Central. It was too expensive to sell in Watson and Compton, and he had the whole place to himself.
Right. So how did this whole thing of crack come about then?
Well, see, crack had already started its way up here. They started seeing crack, people smoking this stuff called base or bazuco down in Bolivia and down in Peru in like the 70s.
Right.
And they knew it was coming up. It was coming up to Central America. And they started seeing it in Los Angeles way back in 1974. I mean, it was very rare.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, it goes that far back.
That was the first time a guy was hospitalized in the country for smoking crack. It was in UCLA in 1974.
Right.
Yeah, it was called Freebase then.
Right.
Okay. Oh, that's what Freebase was.
Yeah.
Okay. Richard Pryor.
But it was different because they used ether then. That's
right.
Why. So people were... The technological advance was going to bicarbonate of soda, so you didn't have that blow-up effect.
Right.
Okay. Now, how is the Bay Area connected to this?
The Bay Area is connected because Meneses ran the cocaine distribution ring from up here.
Okay.
He had a number of dealers living in San Francisco, a lot of relatives of his, and they were selling it up in Portland and Seattle. They had... we did this chart showing that they had hired the Grand Columbia Line in Columbia, these ocean-going freighters, and they would, like, sail along the coast, pull into Los Angeles, dump off cocaine, pull up here, dump off cocaine, and go on up, and they would just dump this stuff in the harbors, and these frogmen would swim it ashore.
Now, this is, like, in the late 70s, early
80s. This is early 80s.
Right.
Early
now, 80s. Were they responsible for supplying the cocaine that that led to, I guess, Felix Mitchell's drug empire? Was he connected with that in any sense?
I have not run across that name.
Okay, okay. So now with respect to this guy, Freeway Rick,
right.
Now you said that in your article that he started selling the cocaine and
right.
he started distributing it to...
Yeah, and he started selling powder.
Okay.
I mean, he said there wasn't any market for crack at that point. And he said when people started figuring out how they could make it and how they could make it so cheap and get off so much with so little money, he said they started asking me, hey, can you make this stuff for us? Can you start making this? And he's set up cookhouses and just, you know, it was, Rick Ross didn't invent crack. Crack was there. It's just people developed a taste for it all of a sudden.
Right.
And he started asking for that instead of powder. And, you know, Rick's a businessman. He gives the customer what they want.
Right. And he started distributing it to the Crips
right.
and the Bloods.
Right.
And
that's who he knew. That was his neighborhood.
Okay. Let me take a couple of calls. People may have some questions or they may have some comments. So let's go to John out of Oakland. John, you're on Street Knowledge. How you doing this morning? John, are you there? Okay, so we missed you, John. So let's go to Shannon out of Ronan Park. Shannon?
Hi, Davey. How you doing?
Good. What you got to say about what we're talking about today?
Well, first of all, I'd just like to thank Gary Webb and you for bringing this issue up to the forefront. And how many times have we said in the black community that all along there was a powerful outside entity bringing this crack cocaine into our community, and now it's being proven today? And I looked at that chart that Mr. Webb's talking about, and it floors me that they apparently landed these drugs on U.S. Air Force Base in Texas.
What? They didn't. They were landing this on...
That's, you know, when I went down to Nicaragua and I started going through the files down there, I found some testimony from this guy who said they were flying it into a base in Texas aboard Salvadoran
That's
military
right.
aircraft.
That's right. And also, very quickly, how did this affect me? I've had friends who could have gone, you know, places and been somebody, very nice young African-American men who are dead or in jail. And why do they take the drugs? I think it's maybe the problems of life. They use drugs to escape or hopelessness and despair. They feel they have no future, so they sell drugs or take drugs. And the very sorriest thing I can say, because I saw this with some of my friends, is role models. Maybe their relatives or relatives' friends did drugs in the house, and that's why they started doing it, too, as youngsters.
Okay. Something to think about. I appreciate the call, okay?
Thank you.
All right, let's go to, looks like Kelowna out of Richmond. You're on Street Knowledge. How you doing? Hello, Kelowna. Are you there? Okay, let's go to Paul out of Daly City. Paul, you're on Street Knowledge.
Hey, good morning, Dave. How's it going?
Good. Talk to us.
Well, I was born and raised in New York City, so I'm back from the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And the issue back then was heroin and stuff, and when people used it, you didn't even know. And so now it's gotten so out of hand that they have all these designer drugs.
Got to talk a little loud so we can hear you.
Oh, now they have these designer drugs and all these crack and this and that, and the two gentlemen that you interviewed hit it right on the nose.
Mm-hmm. And how do we hit it on the nose?
Well, who controls it? I mean, the poor people don't bring it in there.
Right.
We don't grow it. So it's obviously got to come from somewhere. Who lets it get through?
Right.
Big
well,
one.
Well, that's something to think about. Let me ask Makani and also our other guest, Kevin Weston from the Young Comrades. And Gary, what's been the response from the government on this?
The CIA has agreed to do an investigation of it.
They have agreed
yeah,
to do it. How can they do an investigation
well,
when they've been major
question.
Players?
That's a good question. Allegedly, they have this inspector general's office. It's independent. You know, this is sort of the kabuki dance you got to go through in Washington. You got to ask the agency first if they did anything wrong. And if they say no, then everybody goes, well, we don't believe it. We're going to do another investigation. So,
right.
you know, that's the way this is probably going to play out.
McConaughey,
yeah, I was just going to say quickly, I think it's important to understand there's a whole history behind it. There's been a lot of investigations of different kinds of connections. Back in the 50s, there was concern about Air America about a CIA link in supporting insurgents who are fighting mainland China using opium, who are based in what is now Myanmar and Thailand. Air America, according to DEA's own Far East Regional Director, has been implicated in transporting opium, and I'm going to look, you know, from different parts of Southeast Asia. And in Afghanistan, around a whole thing about there's been, you know, this whole thing to look into how the CIA might be linked to drug production in Afghanistan to fund rebels there. And one of the things I think, and I got to say, I think investigations are important and we continue to investigate. But one of the things I'd like to see personally is a class action lawsuit. I think that there's so many people who have suffered, particularly those folks who suffered around homicide, you know, the innocent bystanders around the because that was the real thing that really affected our communities. To force the government through interrogatories, through the legal process to open up, because what happens is the people who are on the inside continue to investigate each other, and we have not seen any answers.
Right. How were you able to get some of this information, Gary?
It's all public record. I mean, we got some of it declassified from the National Archives, but under the Freedom of Information
Act. So this is all public record that we're talking about.
Yeah. Right.
But I just want to say real quickly, and that's the key. The thing is that it's public record. And even Gary's story, as wonderful as it is, it's hardly been picked up by major newspapers, which is totally appalling and amazing. And so it says to me, what is the price? What are the consequences that the government and those people involved will have to pay? And I think the only way we can continue to sort of pressure, make those kinds of consequences happen is through legal action, as opposed to sort of going, okay, go ahead, do like he did, spend a year trying to read this stuff and get to it. That's not fair, and people don't have time.
Right. Let me ask Kevin and Troy for their opinions on this, but let me take a call from Athena first. Athena from San Francisco, you're on Street Knowledge. How you doing this morning?
Hi. I'm just calling to say both my parents were raised over there in Nicaragua, and a lot of this was coming into my house. A lot of this cocaine, all this business was going through my house when I was younger. And it's a trip to really just hear it on the radio now, to have other people, like, kind of expose it. And I'm just glad it's coming, you know, it's coming through, you know, to everybody to let them know that stuff like this was going on, because I have a lot of, you know, Nicaraguan friends that they don't know about this. And, you know, I'm just glad it's coming out.
Right. Why was so much drugs going through your personal household?
Because my father married women from over there to come over here. And the only way they could, you know, survive over here is selling cocaine or prostituting, because there was not a lot of business for immigrant women back then, and a lot of them had needed to sell this stuff to make it in, you know, make it in San Francisco and make it around the Bay Area.
Right.
And he was supplying them, so.
You know, in Gary's story, he talked about, you know, how it devastated the African-American community. Did you see similar effects, and do you see similar effects in the Latino community, in particular the Nicaraguan community, with respect to this drug?
I do, but it's like, it's more on the hush now, like I was saying. It's like, with the Nicaraguan community, you don't see it as much. It's just like, you know, it's covered up. It's, you know, it's not, you know, it's not in the news. It's not, no one's trying to help, you know. And also with the African-American community, you know, it's all fucked up there too. So
right,
it's like messed up in both places, but it's kind of, you know, it's hidden. No one wants to see it. No one wants to talk about it. And it's going to keep on going like that till someone does something about it. So
okay,
get some help.
Well, let me ask Kevin Weston and Troy from the Young Comrades. You guys are out there on the streets, you know, especially dealing with a lot of the young people, especially in the East Bay. How have you seen this whole crack epidemic, and what role has it played in the lives of the young people that you're dealing with day in and day out?
Well, I think most importantly, most importantly, we should understand that CIA agents don't go to jail. Regular citizens do. Let's remember, in 1994, the United States has sent its millionth person to jail. There are 600,000 people on parole, 3 million on probation. And of this, one group that has been kind of left out here is the women. Between 1983 and 1991, in this time when you see a lot of, you know, crack being popular, the rates of women in prison has risen over 150%, from 15,330 to 38,818. Of these, the black women are 46% in the prisons and 43% in jail. 74% of them are unemployed.
Now, is this the result of this sentencing guidelines where you go to jail for a long period of time if you're caught with rock? And
well, it's the unequal imprisonment rates. I mean, you see white people get off on, you know, like you just said, if you have a certain amount of powder cocaine and you have the same amount of rock cocaine, you get a lot more time for the rock cocaine, you know, and because it's that's hitting minority communities and poor communities in general.
Right. Now, how have you seen the effect just on a personal level with the young people that you deal with? Kevin, you want to hit that?
Well, personally, you know, there's been a change in the whole culture. In the 80s, before, when you had groups like Public Enemy and KRS-One and stuff that was talking about positivity, you know, now you have people who are basically propagating this game that the CIA runs, you know, and I think that...
What game is this?
And this is a dope game. This is what you hear on radio stations. People are talking about, you know, getting money and doing all these sort of things. And this shows me that our whole culture is basically our popular culture, our youth culture. The stuff that we live by is now infested with this drug stuff that, you know, hip-hop could be a revolutionary culture, and I think that's what it ought to be. And we've gotten away from
that. Well, you hit a real interesting thing in talking about pop culture, and this is for everybody, including the people we're going to take calls from. I started seeing pop culture kind of legitimize or glamorize is more of a better word. The whole cocaine thing when Miami Vice first started coming out, and there was a fascination with the fast suits and, I mean, the nice suits and the fast lifestyle, and then it just seemed like everybody started building up on it, and then you had your Scarface movies and your Godfather movies, and then a lot of people got hip to the game and said, you know, I can fund my business by, if I just take a little bit of rock, say, like this guy Freeway Rick, make $5,000, make $20,000.
Let me tell you, every crack dealer I talked to, they said the best movie they ever saw was Scarface. Yep. Every one of them said that's what got them going.
And this goes right back to what the sister said, that the biggest problem not necessarily is just the drugs, it's the money that's involved with the drug. You see it being pushed by these rappers every day. You know, get your money, slang your cane, do what you got to do to come up. And you got young people saying, well, damn, if they did it that way, maybe I can do it too. They're not thinking about the consequences of selling drugs to the brother and sister.
Right.
I was just going to say, you know, it's the American way. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, people talk about just say no, but just saying no to money, it, you know, if you think about it, it's just that's sort of anti-American. And the other thing that Brother Troy said about the issue of women is really critical. You see women walking the streets, you know, just and all of the children and grandmothers taking care of babies. And one thing that came up earlier was whether or not this was allowed in our community and the difference in how this works. And one of the things that, I mean, this drug came at a point where we had this massive unemployment. We had a breakdown in the infrastructure. People without health insurance have increased greatly. So those folks who are middle class and were using crack could, like, check in to, you know, your Betty Ford or your equivalent, get on out. And treatment to women, even though there's treatment is only available to 4% of the people who are addicts in this country, this treatment is only available to 1% of the women who are addicts, because there's so few treatment places. And so you look at this welfare, quote-unquote welfare reform,